Welcome to 3.2. Second talk in this morning's session is by Dorothea Hoffman and Ryan Henke, exploring applications of fieldwork data, a case study of Malloc-Malloc complex predicates in discourse.
Hello.
Hello.
All right. So our talk is called Exploring Applications of Fieldwork Data, a case study of Malloc-Malloc complex predicates in discourse. So our case study relies upon older archive data, as well as new data collected from recent fieldwork. We're going to begin our talk with a quick look at the relationship between documentation and archiving, which will take us right into our case study. As documentary linguists, we all know that archiving is essential to documentation. If we're going to dedicate immense amounts of time, money, and energy to preserve endangered languages, our efforts are futile without a plan to preserve those and that information for future generations for a variety of purposes. In recent years, archiving conversations have revolved around two main topics. Number one, we've got best practices for linguistic archiving. What are the best ways to collect, manage, and archive data? Some of the lessons that we've learned have involved using open source formats, using Unicode instead of ASCII characters, having good metadata standards, and so forth. In more recent times, we've been asking, how do we expand the audiences for archives? How do we get the most out of our archives? How do we get a wider range of people to deposit and access materials? And how do we get people to use materials for an expanded range of scientific and community purposes? We've seen a lot of efforts around this component of the conversation of archiving. Dobis, for example, has created a new general portal in recent years to make its data more accessible to scientists and non-scientists who are interested in language questions. And in accordance with these conversations, we started to ask ourselves, who uses archives and for what purposes? In 2011, Peter Austin, for example, asked around at some archives, including the Alaska Native Language Archive and the California Language Archive, and he saw that those two archives are essentially used by speaker communities or their descendants to access materials for cultural, historical, or language learning purposes. On the other hand, archives like Dobis and ELAR, they seem to be used primarily by linguists. Dorothea and I recently did some asking around of linguists on the RNLD listserv, and we found pretty much the same thing. Moreover, the linguists who use archived data for research are typically the researchers who have collected that data, or they are experts in the language. Most often, research involving archival materials involves the more traditional domains of linguistic analysis: phonology, phonetics, morphology, syntax, historical linguistics, and typology. Discourse analysis, on the other hand, are much less common, although some projects have been funded by organizations like Dobis. We found a couple, including the Referentiality Project and the Relative Frequencies of Nouns, Pronouns, and Verbs Cross-Linguistically. So this situation leads us to our case study. So our study revolves around two archival sources of data. Number one will be the data collected by Dorothea in the field since 2012. She uses OLAC metadata standards, as well as additional metadata categories, including who was present during the recording session, who has worked on the data, and what is the physical orientation of speakers when engaged in discourse. And this is good for a lot of the spatial analyses that have been going on lately. All of her data is recorded, time-aligned, transcribed, and translated in Elan with the help of native speakers. It's been glossed and cleaned up in Toolbox and turned into interlinear timeline text. We also have a rough sketch grammar and a 2,000-word dictionary to accompany the data. The second suite of data that we've been using is data collected by a linguist named David Burke in the 1970s, which has been basically untouched since. This data was, of course, collected prior to modern metadata protocols. And moreover, it existed only in audio format until Dorothea and her community members transcribed and translated it. So together we've used this data to look at discourse. Specifically, we've looked at how discourse environments affect syntactic structure. We've looked at complex predicate constructions, discourse markers, and we also did some poking around with nominal classification and word order, but we're not really gonna have time to talk about that today. So with that, here's Dorothea.
All right, so I'm gonna dive right into the data itself. So just one word of this. So we worked on this together, and that's the whole point of this talk, to show that somebody like Ryan, who has never been in the field in Australia, can actually work with the data the way I presented it, and we both worked on it. So looking at Malak, it's a language spoken in the Daly River area. Up here in Northern Australia, it's a highly endangered language with 11 speakers left. One of the interesting features of the language is the complex predicate system, which I'm going to talk about today in a little bit more detail. So in Malak complex predicates, you have the choice between basically three options as a speaker. You can either use just one inflecting verb in your clause. You can, so as in this example here, just yunu. Secondly, you may combine your inflecting verb with a co-verb in a complex predicate, and Malak can actually have up to four of these co-verbs combining with one inflecting predicate. Thirdly, you can have co-verbs without any inflecting verb as sort of semi-independent predicates. As in this example here, as in example three. So these are these occur, for example, in subordinate clauses, or they encode a series of events, or some other discourse-related phenomena. So when we think about complex predicates in discourse, we want to know, so the speakers have this kind of choice, so how do they make that choice of which of these to use, especially when sometimes the co-verb here, the uninflecting part of the co-verb, actually combines with an inflecting verb of the same semantic meaning. Why would speakers do that, and in what situations do they use it? So I found this really interesting example in one of the storytelling sessions. So basically, these are three speakers talking roughly at the same time, and talking a little bit over one another, because an exciting moment in a dreamtime narrative that they are talking about. And they're all saying the exact same thing. They're talking about an animal turning into a dreamtime being, so turning into an everlasting entity on the land. So the first speaker to express this notion actually uses a simple complex predicate, and that's what I call just a complex predicate with one co-verb combining with one inflecting verb here. The second speaker chimes in and uses a serial complex predicate construction, meaning the exact same thing. So she uses the same co-verb pack again, together with a co-verb of motion, and again the same inflecting verb. And the third speaker finally uses just an inflecting verb in a simple predicate. So that leads me to believe that there is actually quite a lot of individual speaker variation and just individual stylistic speaker choice, since this is all spoken really in the very same at the very same time, and speakers tell me that these mean the exact same thing, and the different and some of these are just the directionality of turning into a dreaming can be expressed either as up here in a nominal or down here in a co-verb with a directionality marker. Secondly, one question concerns when we get these kind of what I call extreme serialization, and a bit of a flashcard term, just to say, so when do speakers actually use these really long and complex serial co-verb constructions? Sometimes they use it when there's quite one event that has multiple actions. So in this example, the speaker talks about an animal coming in and out, in and out, in and out continuously. So using titch, chuk, titch, so come out, go in, come out, go in, come out, go in, as a multiple actions. And then finally, he comes back up. So coming in, out, and then out. So that's one way to use these really serial co-verb constructions. The second one would be to describe near synonymous events as an example eight. Here, the first co-verb construction, YIP, means to just, so the crocodile is going around, he's going around hunting, so moving along while hunting. And the second one, hit and come, here combined to mean more or less the exact same film, so exact same thing, so a dynamic motion of hitting. So going along hitting can also mean to kill. Finally, so I found some interesting expressions of serial co-verb expansion in discourse. So when more than one speaker is talking, a speaker might pick up the main narrator's coverbs and one serial coverb construction as sort of a communicative discourse device. So here RK is our main speaker. She talks about, again, this is a mythological narrative. So she talks about a man being thrown into a trap and into the river to drown. So she uses this complex compound coverb here to encode the throwing into the water. A second speaker then, BL, picks up that exact same coverb here, or compound coverb here, and also combines it with another coverb to indicate that, so he's thrown into the water and then bubbles are coming up because he's trying to breathe and he's actually drowning. So picking up the same coverb construction here and combining it with this one in a complex predicate construction is sort of a device to express these really complex coverb constructions. This is then followed by the same speaker RK again, who picks up just the last coverb that says, okay, so bubbles are coming up and they're still coming up, and finally bubbles are coming up and then they stop. So this is a third speaker chiming in again, who just likes to finish up stories, or parts of stories. So she just says, okay, they come up and it's finished, so let's move on to the next part of the story now. So in summary, for these complex predicate constructions, we see that there are a number of features regarding the choice of complex predicates used in discourse. So we can either have individual speaker variation, as we saw in the first example. There can be a quick sequence of events and near synonymous events, or as in this example, speaker interaction leading to really complex constructions. A second short case study regards Malak-Malak discourse markers, and this is actually a study that Ryan did mainly by himself on my data. So we're trying to look at focus markers. So there are some focus markers in Malak-Malak, and I haven't really had a lot of time to look at what they actually do and what happens. But a few things, there's a few observations that we can see. So focus markers might be used to mark when a narration switches from one protagonist to another, and or to a different part of the story. So this seems particularly important when you consider that there's a non-linear ordering of events of indigenous narratives. So the mythological Dreamtime stories in Australia are not following a temporal order of events normally, but they follow a spatial order of events. So people switch around between different parts of the story. So there needs to be some kind of marker in discourse to indicate, okay, I'm switching to a different part or to a different protagonist. So in example 10, there are two different actors. So it's here, it's the blue-tongued lizard. He's walking out there. And then right after that, there's a switch to another protagonist, the goanna, and both is indicated with a focus marker at the very right edge of the clause. And this is where they always occur. They occur at the very right edge of the clause. Can occur with any word or any type of lexeme. Similarly, in the 11, the protagonists switch from the goanna to the blue-tongued lizard in a different narration of the same part of the story. So here, the focus marker actually is on a nominal kumugut. So here, there's a goanna swimming away, and then at the same time, the blue-tongued lizard. So I'm focusing on a switch of protagonist here. He came from a different place to join the goanna. Focus markers may also be used to change topics. So in 12, the focus here is on the crocodile. So speaker BL talks about the crocodile, so we're again with the same story with the man being thrown into the water to drown, and he afterwards turns into a crocodile, being very unhappy with people who did that to him, which is why the crocodile today kills people and animals and anything that comes into the water. So here the speaker talks about the goanna, the crocodile killing everybody in the water. And then the second speaker asks a question to him. So what happened actually afterwards? So again, this is the same speaker that likes to just wrap things up. So she goes like, okay, so we know he kills him. So what does he actually do? Where do we go from here? How does the story go on? So here she uses a focus marker. So where do you go from here, I wonder? And then she herself goes on to talk about a different part of the story, where a number of people that were standing on the riverbank watched that first crocodile come up and kill a dog and they now are still there left as trees watching the river. Finally, focus markers or discourse markers may also indicate a switch of attention and a change in topic. So in example 13, there are three different discourse markers at work here. In 13A, nudge indicates an emphasis for an action. So the emphasis here is that the protagonist comes back and he needs to rest. That's a really important part here. This goes on with another discourse marker, Yera, which places an action into a different deictic center. So here he's at the camp, and then here we go elsewhere into the deictics of the story world, and this is indicated by Yera, and then we switch switch attention again using the focus marker where that we already saw. So he went inside to stay, and then we talk about food. Right. So to sum up, discourse markers may indicate a change of protagonist, a change of topic, or shifting emphasis, deixis, and attention in discourse. So as Ryan already very briefly mentioned, so expanding the study, we want to continue working on this in more detail. So one thing we looked at just preliminarily was word order preferences. So Malak is a free word order language. It seems as if initial observation suggests that Malak speakers use flexible word order for stylistic effect in discourse. So again, in this kind of interactive way that we saw with some of the complex predicates. And also, secondly, the use of nominal classifiers, which are also optional. And these seem to be markers of definiteness, and they can distinguish proper names from generic terms. So I can give you some examples of this. We have some of that in the appendix, but we didn't want to talk about this today in more detail.
Okay. So in the end, we're hoping that this study can contribute to current conversations in a couple of ways. Number one, we hope to add to the work of best practice advocates who continue to call attention to the need for improved methods and tools for documentation. They also call for better metadata and more useful primary data, as well as wider promotion of best practices to linguists and speaker communities. In a nutshell, this is part of the effort to show that following accepted standards for collecting, managing, and archiving data can make data more accessible and usable by others. Our study would not be possible with a lot of the older archive data that exists now. The data collected in the 1970s, as we mentioned, has been untouched ever since, and it's practically useless without a native speaker or an expert in the language. The new data, Dorotea's data, which has been collected since 2012, has been designed to be useful to linguists who are not experts in Australian languages, but are also looking for data from a broader variety of source languages. For example, her data was annotated in a way that allowed a non-expert like me to go through and look for syntactic patterns. This allowed us to engage in a collaborative study, rather than Dorotea having to do everything by herself. This is a good illustration of how best practices, as well as the current trend away from the more traditional lone wolf documentation model, can go hand in hand. And we've seen a lot of the work here at ICLDC revolves around collaborative models too. Finally, we hope we've shown that you can use archive data to do something a little different, to branch out from traditional phonetics, phonology, syntax, or historical linguistics. You can look at discourse too. So with data collected and managed under best practices, we can all make sure our work is as valuable as possible to a wide user base for a long period of time. Thank you. Just pretend like you don't see this. We'll go to the title. Any questions?
Just a reminder, I'm sure you must have said this, but was the older data already transcribed or
no.
Just audio?
Okay. It was only audio. There was no metadata with it. All I know about it is that it was recorded between the 1970s, sometime between 1971 and 1973. And I also don't know if it's narration, if it's monologue, if it's elicitation, because the recorder actually in between, there was a lot of breaks in between when whoever elicited or talked actually cut out what he said. So I don't actually know what anything is about. It was wonderful to try and figure out what was being talked. And I had to work with the speakers themselves and who then could identify the speakers, like, oh, I think that sounds like Old Mickey, and then they could tell me the story of Old Mickey, which is really nice. But yeah, what everything is actually about is kind of really hard to grasp. It was basically the data was pretty much useless if there weren't any more speakers left.
Usually the tech that we have for documenting and then archiving, it seems like most of the weight is on, you know, sounds, phonetic features, and then quite a bit on word order and maybe even sentence structure. But there doesn't seem to be a lot on capturing discourse. In other words, software that is good at capturing and illustrating discourse, like you've done here. So were you able to use some software that helped you capture that, or?
No, I mean, we are unfortunately not software developers or anything like that. So it would have been nice to have that in a bit more of an automated process. But I mean, what we ended up doing, we had Elan files, and you can export those into any text format that you want. So when you're only interested in the actual text and the discourse itself, so you can just have the, say, the morpheme and the glossing and the free translation exported from Elan, and then you can look for patterns like this, and you can even, you know, just like do a search in a PDF file for focus markers that were marked as focus markers, or for certain types, or for certain some of these complex predicates. When I looked for them, I mean, I know which ones are potentially more prone to occur in serial verb constructions, and then I can look for those and see when they happen. So, I mean, I don't know how you worked on this when you...
Yeah, that's pretty much it. So, in the future, we'd like to have more rich, discourse-oriented, you know, tagging of data, but for the moment, we're starting with pretty preliminary stuff, yeah.
It's a bit of a messy slide, but I can go to that. Basically, I mean, all I did was, it's always hard to actually, when you look at word order, to find these nice OVS type order things when you actually have an explicitly expressed object. And in Malak there is the pronoun is a pronominal suffix that directly indicate into the inflecting verb, so we don't usually get this as a free pronoun or overtly expressed protagonist. So one of the things that seems to be a preferred order in Malak is to at least have the verb sort of medially, so either OVS or SVO. So what I did was basically just having my interlinear glossed examples and tagging them with very simply VOS. And so in this sort of longer stretch of discourse, one thing I noticed was, so here, so there's different types, different speakers, I think it's actually the same speaker, sort of moving along using sort of directing, well, how do you say that? Combining the word order with one another. So here she goes on, she has a VO word order, and then the S, it sort of comes as an afterthought, there's a short intonation break. And she picks up subject here again in the second one. So we go from VOS and then we go SV, and then again we use V, picking up again from there. So we use VO, but she's going from here, then just having one talk about just a bit of a more expansion on what is being talked about, and then again, so V from O and then VS here. So that's just sort of a very preliminary type of tagging I was trying to do for these longer little bit of discourse. But basically, I mean, all you can do is look at a transcribed text and either looking at case marking when they're there, but they're very, very, they're really I mean, this example, I think there's not a single ergative pace marker or anything, even though there are. Yeah, so here, we actually have a transitive marker here, but there's no ergative pace marking. I mean, there's here, we have the free pronoun back here, so that's all there is. But it's kind of hard, you can't just look for ergative case. It doesn't really help you much in this, or look for my absolutive. Yeah, so it depends on how you do it, and I guess you need to, and that's why you need to have sort of a grammar, at least a sketch grammar accompanying any of the data to know about these kind of specialties about the language.